You too could replicate the 2025 Bahrain Grand Prix conditions by sticking an axe in your fuse box. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Oh, and Oscar Piastri won the Grand Prix, apparently. But, you know, we'll never know until the graphics department refreshes the page. Hi, everybody. Episode 575 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Or should I say good day? Because the win in Bahrain this past weekend came from the land down under, as Oscar Piastri became the first man this season to join the multiple Grand Prix winners club. We'll be talking all about that over the next 45 minutes or so on this F1 edition of Motorsport 101. As promised last week, there will be three episodes across this week. It's a loaded week. I mean, arguably one of the most loaded weekends of motorsport I can ever remember. I mean, RJ, I'm with RJ O'Connell for this episode. Just RJ, Cam will be here hopefully later on in the week. Glad you could join us as ever. But RJ, we had Formula 1, MotoGP, IndyCar, NASCAR, IMSA was on the IndyCar undercard at Long Beach. Sadly, of course, we're gutted you weren't there, but you know, it happened. It was certainly a thing. Super GT kicked off their season this weekend. Well, Superbikes raced at Assen with a couple of shock winners over there as well. Andrea Locatelli is a World Superbike winner at last. Shit was weird. Formula E was at Homestead. That was a weird
GT World Challenges kicked off their seasons this weekend. Yeah, this was a lot. If you're a fan that's just looking for, like, God, I want to spend as much time in front of a screen watching motorsport as I can, this is great.
Yeah. There was literally something for everybody, because even if you want to talk about, like, general sport, we had a classic Paris-Roubaix and a classic cycling race, which Matthew Van Der Poel would go on to win. Tadej Pogacar gave him a good old fright until his bike suddenly stopped working. Rory McIlroy finally wins a major for the first time in 11 years as he claims the Masters in a playoff against Justin Rose, and we win. It was so crazy in the UK. Sky Sports had its most watched ever day in its over 30 years of existence. Over 7.5 million people apparently tuned in across the day, which is ridiculous. So I think the big fact is obviously Premier League football, because that was a big Newcastle Man United game, Bahrain Grand Prix, and the Masters going into the night, of course. I think it finished around like 12:30 UK time. So absolutely crazy weekend of sports. Nuts. Ridiculous.
Yeah. Quite a bit crazy. I expect ratings Tuesday tomorrow, time of recording, to be an absolute bloodbath to see how NASCAR and IndyCar match up against the Masters going in the final round. Because they all clashed at the same time. It's great. Bristol was boring. Long Beach was fine. Masters was fun. Racing was fun. Let's talk about some of it.
We were talking about Formula One's Bahrain Grand Prix, the main event, you could argue, of the entire weekend's festivities. McLaren not quite getting the 1-2, but Oscar Piastri winning by about 16 seconds in the end, only because George Russell had nothing short of an electrical short circuit happening in his car at the same time. We'll talk about that. Ferrari and where they're at. Crisis talks apparently at Red Bull Racing. And no, it's not over their second driver for once. Alpine's back. V10s are on the shelf, apparently. Who knows? Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria. We'll break it down all over the next 45 minutes or so. But before we do that, there's some places you can find us. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101 if you want to get full episodes on YouTube. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you want to follow us personally on Blue Sky, you can at dreharrison.bsky.scotial. Same for RJ O'Connell. It's exactly how our actual names are spelt, if that helps. We're on Instagram and Motorsport101Pod if you want all the updates on when this content goes out, including some video highlights of the show and me monologuing about motorsport in general, if you're into that sort of thing. And of course, if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon. Patreon.com/Motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier, where you can listen to these episodes live as they are being recorded, as Jason, Ghost Raptor, and Emma are all doing right now. Thank you very much for listening in. I hope you guys enjoy the show. Rose up there in the chat says, worth every penny. You sick human. I appreciate you, Connor. And of course, the website, motorsport101.com, for all those details. And of course, bonus ring content from your mans. Yours truly on everything that came out of this week and by the time this goes out. Still got an IndyCar review to write. This was a long ass weekend, let me tell you.
Buddy.
Oi, oi, to say the least, it's been loaded. And that's not even the day job. Right, without further ado, let's get into episode 575 and, of course, the 2025 Bahrain Grand Prix.
So, it was a tale of two McLarens in Bahrain, McLaren's home race, of course. Oscar Piastri, often criticized for under-delivering qualifying to give him more work in the race, actually nailed his final qualifying lap to take pole position for the Bahrain Grand Prix. Lando Norris was scruffy and could only manage sixth on the grid. In the race, Piastri handled his business from the front of the field. He won the race by 15 seconds. Norris actually overshot his grid bots as they were lined up to take the start. He picked up a five-second time penalty. Piastri weathered the storm with an aggressive Mercedes strategy. Norris had to fight the gauntlet of Lewis Hamilton, Charles Leclerc, and ultimately failed to pass George Russell on the last lap in a fight for second place. You get Piastri, Russell, Norris, your top three. And with all that, Piastri is just 3 points behind Norris as McLaren take the top two spots in the driver standings. Extend their lead in the constructors to 58 points after just four races. And if you are wondering what became of Max Verstappen, well, he's still close, but it's an 8-point deficit, and this weekend's results were not exactly encouraging, and it's not all his fault. But Dre, I first want to ask you about the shifting dynamics of McLaren. I want to throw you a high hard one because this weekend, you had gone on record as saying that like Oscar still needs to prove something, and Lando is not the bottling merchant that everybody says he is.
I must admit I might have struck out on this one. I'm punting on this one, folks. I ate shit for that take. I'm not gonna lie to you. That was a bad beat right there. I mean, Sunday morning I put a thread out on Blue Sky basically saying, no, I think some of the Lando Norris is a choker or a bottler memes or mentality were a bit overrated and a little bit overhyped. And of course, he overshoots his grid box on the grid after a poor qualifying run and basically struggles to finish in third when Piastri wins a race by 16 seconds.
I'm with you there that generally speaking, I think it's overblown, like Lando is. Because this is the most confounding thing to me. So, like, for a while now, McLaren has not had a car that can regularly compete for wins at this level. And during that time, from about 2019, I'd say 2023, early 2024, Lando's generally gotten the most out of the car that he possibly can. Now, all of a sudden, when the expectations are raised upon him, it's like he underdelivers.
I think a lot of people have been burying the lead on this one. Lando's been ranting about this to anyone that's been prepared to listen. He does not like this new McLaren. He's made it very clear from day one that the MCL 39 does not suit his driving style. He said it first weekend of the year in Australia. He went into a lot of depth that first press conference on Thursday where he said, look, normally, McLaren asks us as the drivers for a lot of input into how our cars feel. This was the first time that Norris said to McLaren, and I quote, make the fastest car available, I'll just adapt to it. And that's seemingly what McLaren has done. And Lando, again, doubled down on these claims after Bahrain this past weekend, saying, look, I am not gelling with this car, and I don't know why. It's a theory that I came around with around sort of China, because Norris kind of had a bit of a Horlicks of a China weekend as well, with the poor qualifying, the not so great sprint results. You know, he got the second in the Grand Prix when it mattered most, but again, was a bit lucky to even get that second, given his car's brakes were sticking to the floor. I said at the time that I think McLaren might have blunted their most surefire weapon, and that was Norris's qualifying speed. We forget he had 8 pole positions last year, had the lowest average qualifying position of any driver on the grid last year, better than Max by just a smidge. Like, that was a weapon that McLaren had, and they utilized that on the way to 6 wins in the Constructors' title last year.
Especially a series where, you know, it's Formula One. We know the state of racing most days. If you have track position, that's a really good thing for you.
It's a weapon. It's arguably the most important weapon you can have in this sport. You get to dictate the terms of engagement. We saw it in Japan just a week ago. Max Verstappen being the first car on the grid and knowing that if he gets a clean start, he's not going to be passed on track unless the delta is enormous, which it wasn't. And obviously Red Bull's blushes being spared, it single-handedly won him a Grand Prix. You know, in a car that, looking back on it now in the power of hindsight, is looking like a donkey by comparison. But Suzuka spared their blushes and Max cashed in an advantage and got a win out of it. Like, I would say McLaren might have blunted their weapon with Norris here, but the blust side for him is that McLaren doesn't have one quality driver. It has 2.
Yeah.
And Oscar Piastri is loving this McLaren right now. He is driving as well as he ever has. This is no longer a surprise that Piastri is putting it all together and gets a weekend where he can win. He's now won 2 out of the last 3 and has looked very comfortable in those 2 wins leading from the front. He's becoming McLaren's safe pair of hands, which is something that, you know, I openly admit, I'm not fully convinced on Oscar yet, because I think a lot of people gave him a bit of a pick-me-up because of how Australia played out.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, all 3 of the leading guys in that race made mistakes when the rain came down and the shock of the rain coming down when they entered sector 3.
Yeah.
But Norris and Max were able to save their cars. Oscar didn't.
Yeah.
And that was a 23-point loss to Norris right there. And then given he would go on to win, I think a lot of people were like, yeah, look at the grid on Piastri reversing out of that wet grass and salvaging 2 points. Woo! And not realizing, like, it's a bit like Marc Marquez's saves in MotoGP. A save is still a mistake. You know, and I think a lot of people don't like it, accepting that fact. So I was quite hot take-ish in saying that I think George Russell's been the best driver in Formula One so far this season. And I got a lot of pushback from the Piastri camp on this.
We'll get back to that one, but it comes from a place of like, yeah, we know Oscar Piastri has this in the bag. You just need to see it more often, because Japan was really his other big missed opportunity. He qualifies third and he pretty much stays there all day. But I like to think the qualifying is getting better. It was 20-4 last year. It's 2-2 to start this year. And Piastri has 2 wins. He should be evaluated on the tier of being a 5-star prospect like Lando was when he came into the sport.
Yeah, and I honestly don't think he was being looked at in that way. I think he got a big old benefit of the doubt for his first 2 years in F1. He's not going to have a choice this year, because the way this year is playing out, it's going to be a 1-car championship. It's going to be which McLaren wins the world title by the way this is playing out right now, because we've seen no evidence consistently that any other car is going to be a constant threat to this McLaren. We all know that McLaren lost Japan in qualifying. It wasn't because their car was slower in Japan. It was because track position was everything and they botched qualifying. Like, their drivers are still fuming. Norris in particular has made a string of minor mistakes that have added up over the course of the year. And Piastri's not been perfect either. but they have certainly the least amount of question marks, and I think they have a card that's probably 3 temps quicker than the field to compensate for a lot of that right now. And that is likely going to be enough to make this a Battle of the McLarens for the championship. And that's where it's going to be fascinating, because for me right now, the weaknesses of Norris being better and the worse than maybe than he was last year, and the strengths of Piastri starting to mitigate some of his problems, they're starting to converge. And that is where it's going to be potentially a fascinating title fight brewing.
Yeah, this is both drivers are up to the task. They both have their strengths and weaknesses. I expect this will get a lot more interesting as the season goes on. And we talked about it. McLaren is going to have to make a decision. Do they want to stay hands off, or is there going to be forced where they have to pick one to back for the championship?
I don't think they can do that now. I think McLaren's too far gone to start playing the 1-2 driver game.
Yeah.
You've let Oscar Piastri do his thing now to the point where there's an argument you can make that you can no longer play the Norris is better definitively argument. The time to do that was last year when Piastri was 40-plus points behind Norris in the championship. And as we all know, with papaya rules, with Baku, and how the back end of last year played out, they only did it when they did it arguably 3 or 4 rounds too late. And even then, they didn't really implement this system properly. It was a mess. They went back and forth on it. Like, the drivers took matters into their own hands. And it was a mess. Ultimately, I don't think it really mattered because Brazil happened and McLaren lost any chance of the driver's title after that weekend was over. But they're too far gone. They can't now pick one over the other. Their general attitude with their drivers has been let them fight this entire time. They've got to let them fight now. There'd be uproar. You don't sign Oscar Piastri to a 3-year extension to tell him, oh, by the way, you're being the number 2 guy behind Lando.
Yeah.
You can't do it. You've made a commitment that your team's going to be built off the back of 2 elite drivers. This is what you're going to have to accept. Especially when, like Mercedes was a decade ago, they're now the number 1 team in the sport. Maybe not with as dominant an advantage as Mercedes had back then, certainly. But you can't pick one over the other now. You've put them both on a plinth to say, boys, have at it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how much longer Zach's going to be able to protect that whole happy families vibe, because these two are going to be competing for a title now.
Well,
that destroys friendships. You saw it with Rosberg and Hamilton. They were best mates before they became teammates. And we all saw how toxic that relationship got by the end of their 4 years together.
We all saw that when Rosberg retired, it moved Mercedes to bring in somebody that was 90% of what Lewis Hamilton was in Valtteri Bottas, 95% in his best days, but never 100 to threaten that harmony. Now it's not the case. And generations past, McLaren fans would always boast that we do things better at Ferrari. Ferrari uses team orders and structured hierarchy to always benefit the number one and stifle competition. We don't do that. We're McLaren. We let our drivers race. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, if I'm Lando Norris, I really, really want to bounce back at Saudi Arabia. I really want to do that.
If you give Piastri 3 out of 4, people are going to start talking.
Ooh, this conversation is going to be real uncomfortable.
Because, like I said, I stand by this even after this weekend. I don't think Lando Norris is the choker that some people like to think that he is. He's a damn good racing driver.
Yeah.
Look, a lot of people's evaluation into 2024 boiled down to, did you think Norris had a genuine shot at the title? If you thought the answer to that question was yes, then you probably were quite down on this season. If the answer to that question was no, you probably thought it was a fantastic year.
Or to McLaren.
Or you worked at McLaren, in which case we totally weren't in the driver's fight. No.
After we completely redesigned the car and shot up from midfield to top of the table it so quickly that our detractors think that we are cheating to do all of this.
Yeah. Not really a fair fight for McLaren in some instances, but this is where we're at now, unfortunately.
This is how you gauge the second most successful team in the history of the sport. Dre, you mentioned this. You feel strongly that George Russell was the second best driver in the sport. He had a tough day, and yet it didn't show in the result. He still managed to split the McLarens and finish second in the Grand Prix.
This was the most impressive George Russell drive he's had of the lot this season so far. And look, I said on Blue Sky, I said after the race that I think George is the best driver in F1 so far this season. And to back up my argument, where's he gone wrong this year?
Not many places. He was third, fifth, and second, constantly top five. Antonelli had a really, really tough result, did not have the strategy to work, but he did show glimpses of what can be. And George Russell is only 14 points out of the championship. I know it's very early days, and we don't expect the Mercedes to be anything more than the second or third best car on the grid some days.
What George Russell is right now is what Sebastian Vettel was in 2015 when he joined Ferrari. I think he's going to be the antagonist. I don't think Red Bull's got the car for this long term. I think Red Bull will have a few tracks that mitigate a lot of their problems, and they might get up there with Max if everything clicks. But I think right now, from what I've seen so far this season, the Mercedes is the number two car on the grid right now, and it's a bit more of a consistent challenger than it was last year, where it was all over the place in terms of being a Goldilocks car. A car that could work in the right conditions, in the right setting, in the right moment, but on a bad day would be down in 7th and 8th. Like, George has been exceptional this year. He's barely put a foot wrong all year. Qualified front row again. It would have been front row on the grid itself if it wasn't for a controversial estimated time release from the pits error from his own team during qualifying. But he's had two front row starts this year already, splitting the McLarens up. His one lap pace has been incredible. His race pace has been superb. He's barely put a foot wrong all year. And in this Grand Prix, he had multiple electronical problems, including a brake-by-wire failure, a DRS wing that wasn't operating on its own. It had to be manually opened and closed, and that was the same button as the backup radio because his main radio button was not working. There was a risk the steering wheel was going to shut off entirely. And he was on a 24-lap old soft tire at the end of that race and having to hold off Lando Norris in a far quicker car, and he pulled it off. How is that not phenomenal? How is that not the drive of the season so far? Anyone?
It's up there. It's up there along with what Verstappen did in Japan.
It's a stunning drive. Like, I don't see how anyone can't be massively impressed with how George pulled that off. Like, I think that's phenomenal. Like, it's, if there was any niggling doubt about George Russell still after the end of 2024, because a lot of people, I think, still evaluated Lewis Hamilton there last year with a degree of rose-tinted spectacles. This is George Russell's team now. He's leading this team, and he's doing it brilliantly. He's not put a foot wrong all year, and he's keeping himself in contention just by not making mistakes and just getting everything out of this Mercedes package. This was the weakest Mercedes has been all year, and he finished second. He beat a McLaren straight up. Like, I don't know what more you can ask out of the man than that. Like I said, it's peak Vettel in 2015, where we all knew Ferrari didn't have the car to challenge Mercedes week in, week out. But if everything came into play and it was the right scenario, Vettel could split the Mercs, maybe even go one better and win the odd race or two. I could see that happening with George this year if everything goes his way, because like I said, these McLaren drivers are vulnerable. They've made mistakes this year. There's no doubt about it. And there could be a round later on this year where George could punish them.
On the other hand, where is Ferrari been? Now, this was a better result than they've had all season. Fourth for Leclerc, fifth for Hamilton. That's better. That's about closer to what you expected. But again, this is a team that we talked about as being potential dark horse outside title favorites. They are a distant fourth in the World Constructors Championship, almost 100 points behind what McLaren has hauled in. Still have yet to score a podium finish.
Anyone starting to get the impression that the China sprint win for Hamilton was an outlier here? Because that's the vibe I'm getting.
What's gone wrong here?
It's hard to put a finger on it. I mean, I don't think there's any outright problem. I mean, Ferrari did talk about a big radical redesign of its car. This wasn't an incremental step on last year's car, which, let's not forget, was very close to winning the Constructors' title. They were 14 points off the top in the end. There was an argument you could make they should have won the Constructors' last year with how the middle of that calendar year went out and the Barcelona upgrade package that went completely wrong for them and lost them 2 months of the year in terms of development. They've had a big radical redesign. It seemingly made them worse relative to McLaren. And it does not help. And this is, again, this might be seen as another hot take. I don't think Lewis has been that great this year so far. Now, a part of that, I think, is expected because he has to adapt. It's a brand new lifestyle for Lewis. He's got to be in Italy. It's a new team, new brakes, you know, new car entirely. That is going to take some time to adapt. The other half of me, the more cynical half of me, is going, but you're the greatest of all time. How much of that is meant to compensate for these issues if you're so good? Because a lot of people walked into this Hamilton season at Ferrari, giving him every benefit of the doubt and thinking, why can't we compete for a championship right now? I have colleagues at the day job on Autosport that were adamant that Hamilton was going to be a title contender and could surprise people. That hasn't happened yet. Like, again, I think the safety car, to a degree, spared some of Hamilton's blushes during this race. I think he was comprehensively worse than Leclerc was this weekend, and he wasn't great in China. He was beaten by Leclerc then with a broken front wing, and he was nowhere in Japan either. I mean, he was a bit more optimistic after the race in Bahrain by finishing fifth, and of course, like, Ferrari did bring a new floor upgrade to this race, and it seemingly went over well with both of its drivers. But he was apologizing to his team after qualifying because he was out-qualified by Leclerc by 6 tenths. Lewis Hamilton, out-qualified by 6 tenths. Straight up.
Yeah. Second for Leclerc on the grid, ninth for Hamilton. And we know Leclerc has been doing exactly what he needs to do. He's pretty much getting the most out of what he can with this strategy and the setup as it is. You don't want to write off Hamilton just yet, but I agree. It's not looking great to start.
You could make a case, maybe not a winning one, that of the big seven, I would say, the two McLarens, the two Mercedes, if you want to throw Kimi Antonelli in there,
yeah,
but the two Ferraris and Max, Hamilton might be the weakest of those seven pound for pound the way this season has played out so far. It's maybe not a winning argument, but I think it's certainly an argument you can make. And that, I don't think anybody was realistically expecting that when the season started in March.
Hamilton, who, let's not forget, statistically the greatest qualifier in the history of the Formula One World Championship, more pole position than anybody else, has only made the third row once this year. I would like for him to change that, but some of it is not in his control.
No, it isn't. And to be fair, like I said, Ferrari, I think, is a little bit worse overall as a team, pound for pound, compared to what they were in the back end of last year when they were legitimately giving McLaren a bloody nose. But you can't soak in the hype of bringing in Lewis Hamilton and not have your expectations be sky high.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You signed Lewis Hamilton. You're going to have people waxing lyrical, and the race pace is not there for Lewis just yet. And look, again, I'm not calling this whole thing a write-off. I'm fucking wearing a Ferrari shirt right now as I speak. Do you think I want to call this a wash right now in April? Of course I don't. But looking at the body of evidence of the first four races, and that is a significant sample size, it's not going well, Brav. It's not going well.
Well, it could be going worse as we continue to climb down the ladder of constructor power rankings. Okay, we got to climb up a bit because Red Bull Racing is still ahead of Ferrari in the World Constructors Championship, but this was a tough weekend. Now, I can say Yuki Tsunoda was not letting the side down. He got his first point for the team. He was within 10 cents of Max Verstappen's pace, which is good. The problem was that Red Bull finished sixth and ninth, which is not up to the standards that Red Bull Racing and Honda have set together, and especially not what you would expect after Max Verstappen had such a perfect weekend in Japan, to where we were thinking, depending on that technical directive, he's not out of this. But this is a weekend that makes you think, actually, he might be.
Well, what better way to describe it than from the man himself? When, and look, again, day job, I work at Autosport. You know, I get little bits of insider information, which I can't go into all the time publicly. But when I'm editing our journalists' videos and podcasts every day during a race weekend, you learn a few things. And one of the things is Max Verstappen is always a lot more open to the Dutch media than he is to the English media.
Oh, yeah.
General rule of thumb, drivers are always a bit more comfortable in their mother tongue, so to speak. He told the Dutch press straight up on Saturday, I'm not in this championship, I'm taking part. Which is about as damning an indictment that Verstappen has given since the year began. Allegedly, he told the team during pre-season testing that this very track, you know, about 6 weeks ago, we are about half a second off where we need to be.
He was 34 seconds off the race winner Oscar Piastri by the end of it all.
And this is a proper track.
Yeah.
Like, this is a track where the teams know better than pretty much any other track on the calendar, barring maybe Catalunya because of all that testing mileage they do. Yeah. But Bahrain is a proper track. High degradation, a lot more conventional than most tracks on the calendar, certainly more than Japan, certainly more than Australia, where Max was second on the day and nearly ran Norris out to win that one. Like, this is, I mean, look, from what I've been told, it was panic stations at Red Bull. There was an emergency meeting called between Horner, Marco, Paul Moynihan, Pierre Wache. You know, there was talk in the press that Verstappen's manager went up to Helmut Marko's face and gave him both barrels in anger about how that car was. Like, Helmut Marko was openly telling the media that they're concerned that Max might walk.
Yeah, because now it's like, and I know it's not from like any reputable sources, but they've heard that like, oh, he's got a top three championship clause in his contract, just like Sebastian Vettel did up until 2014. And he might break that. Now, we can get into the minutia of where could he possibly go after this. This isn't great. This feels like a carbon copy of Seb coming out of 13 into 14 with those four straight titles. And he now just feels like a side piece of this championship. It's a bit different because Vettel that year was being outperformed by Daniel Ricciardo, when this year we know that Yuki Tsunoda is taking some time to figure this setup out and is not expected to be outdoing Max Verstappen every weekend.
No.
But if that doomsday scenario comes from Red Bull, that can't be great.
Well, there's been no evidence in the last 7 years that anyone else can perform in a Red Bull at Verstappen's level since Max really got up there and was winning on a semi-regular basis. Some of that is the fact that Red Bull just wasn't there when Max first joined that team. I've said before, the first time that Verstappen really had a car that could challenge for the title was 2021.
Yeah.
The first year he won it. Uh-huh. Like 2020, he wasn't there yet. McLaren was dominant that year. Hamilton won 11 Grand Prix that year. No, so, and I agree with you, RJ, in that if Max declares he wants out, no one in the front is blowing their team up to bring him in. Ferrari just spent a bucket load of cash on Lewis Hamilton, and Charles Leclerc is the destined chosen son of Enzo Ferrari himself. Yeah. McLaren has their lineup, and it locked in till 2027 at the earliest.
Uh-huh.
And Mercedes, can you let George Russell walk now?
Can you pay George Russell ungodly sums of money to tell him to drive for a different team?
And the other major option, Aston Martin, are cheeks right now.
Yeah, Aston Martin is not good. They are a narrow seventh in the championship. They've had back-to-back scoreless races. Fernando Alonso has still not put up a point. And even then, your options are wait for Lance Stroll to become so bored of driving that he decides to retire, or wait for Fernando Alonso to be so disillusioned that the setup isn't coming along as quickly as he'd like, and play out Dre scenario that he retires.
And look, I openly still think that's a long shot. I'm just saying, I think it's wild that Fernando Alonso, in the year of our Lord 2025, is 17th in the championship right now and hasn't scored through four weekends.
Yeah, and this is off the back of Lance Stroll. Like, again, this is the endearing thing about Lance Stroll. First two races, great. This is what you are capable of. Last two races, awful
form.
This is why nobody likes you. And man, oh man, I don't know if Max Verstappen wants to walk into that straight away.
How big a check would Lawrence Stroll have to cut to make that work?
He might. What was that ludicrous offer that they proposed him?
A billion, allegedly. I don't buy it for a second, but
they might have to start with like a half a bill.
Because I was going to say, look, we know for a fact Mercedes openly offered Verstappen $135 million, I think it was, last year. When, again, Toto was lying through his goddamn teeth when he said, when Hamilton left, it took me 2 seconds and I brought in Antonelli. Bullshit. We all knew you were negotiating with Max, right? And it was public knowledge that they had bid over $130 million to bring Max in. Now, look, this is why I think the Aston Martin rumor was bullshit. Aston's not offering 8x market value to try and bring him in. That's preposterous. Like, that's a significant percentage of the value of Aston Martin as an entire brand. Like, that would be as wacky as the old story of Eddie Jordan offering half his team to get Ayrton Senna in the 90s. That would be the level of clout we'd be talking to try and make this happen. And they already gave up a chunk and $20 million a year just to get Adrian Newey through the door. Like, it's not happening. Like, we've got to cut this out. And I don't think Max is actually going to walk here. I just think the Red Bull cauldron is one of boiled piss and drama. They are the Kardashians of Formula One. So any story that comes out of that camp with Max, with Jos, with Helmut, with Christian, and all those personalities there is going to get times by five. You know, that's just how it is at Red Bull, because they're reaping what they sow. You know, it really is as simple as that. Like, Red Bull wanted to be the drama team, and now they are, and now their star driver is having a piss and a moan, rightly so, because Red Bull look directionless as a team right now.
Yeah. Are clearly not capable, as well-rounded as it should be. Their saving graces are that Matt still has it and is still on their payroll for now. And this was a better second race out than Yuki Tsunoda, which is interesting because leading into that race, it looked like he had fallen further back, and then the race comes and he's just like, okay, he's done well. We'll forgive the little mix up with Carlos Sainz there. You know, he's very lucky not to get a penalty, but 2 points is 2 points, and he wasn't completely embarrassed.
Highest finish for a Red Bull second driver in 175 days. We'll take it.
Yeah, it's really one of the big reasons why. God, could you imagine if Red Bull has to face a scenario like, well, Max is gone. We got no choice but to keep Yuki Tsunoda.
Well, let's put it to you this way. Tsunoda made Q3 outright and got minor points. I'm not sure what Red Bull could realistically ask more of him right now, given the state of their car, because right now, at best, they are fourth best right now. Your pass score is eighth.
You know who is not worse in the championship anymore is Alpine. They were the one team that didn't have a point going into the season, going into the Bahrain Grand Prix, and now they got points, six of them via Pierre Gasly finishing seventh. And I'll say it, Alpine looked real good all weekend long. You think Bahrain is a high-speed track? That's not going to suit the Alpine power unit. There's only one real long straightaway, but otherwise they were very good. But there's an interesting dynamic to this, is that Pierre Gasly got all the points. Jack Doohan, for most of the weekend, Friday heading into Saturday qualifying, was as quick, if not quicker, right up until Q2, where he sits tenths behind, and right up till the race, where he finishes 14th. Interesting. Now, apparently we're hearing that he's bought a little bit more time, staving off the Colapinto-sized threat in the back of the room there. What do you make of Alpine? Good that they're back.
I mean, it's nice to see from Alpine that their car is not a complete lemon. There clearly is something here. And the one thing we've always said about Alpine is that they make good chassis. And in Bahrain, yes, it is a power track, but a lot of lap time around Bahrain is won and lost in Sector 2. Which is a very twisty, very technical sector. A lot of fast left rights. So there's a couple of hairpins.
Turn 10 is the worst corner of the one.
Oh, it's like the downhill camber, heavy braking, second gear left-hander. It is a nasty, nasty corner. Alpine was as quick as anybody in the middle of that track this weekend. They've got a good chassis. That's more than obvious. So much so it can clearly compensate for the power unit lacking maybe 30 horsepower, which we've long known the cat's been out of the bag with Alpine and their power unit supply and their outright performance for some time now. Glad that it came around at a time like this, because, and look, we know that Pierre Gasly's a quality driver. Like, give him a car that's capable and he will perform, and he did that the back end of last year, and the first chance Alpine looks decent, he brings home 6 points. He was good in Australia as well, to be fair. Like, so I knew Alpine would get on the board eventually. Like, their car wasn't such a stinker like this time last year, where it's like, could they go scoreless for the year? No, they were going to get points. But, pardon me, but, like, Gasly was holding P6 until the final lap of this race when Verstappen beat him to turn one. But they've got a track that suits them. They've got a car that isn't a donkey. It's got a good chassis, good turn-in. They will get points here and there. If they can get some upgrades here and there, they can mitigate some of that power on more technical circuits. I think they can still contend for maybe the top 6 place. Because they're not a million miles away from Aston Martin and Williams and even Haas, who, you know, are scoring points, but they're not big points.
Yeah.
You know, like Haas got both cars in the points this weekend, but it was 8th and 10th. So, okay, it's 5 points. It's good, you know, and Haas, I'm glad they've seemingly mitigated their high-speed problems. I don't know how they're going to get on a Jetta this weekend, but we'll have to wait and see how that plays out, but... Good for Gasly. To answer your question about Jack Doohan, this is a big old coin flip for me, thinking about it. Because, right, on the one hand, you can say the internals look good. Like, John Noble wrote a piece about this in The Race this morning, basically saying that doing is apparently falling into a lot of favor. He's ticked a lot of boxes behind the scenes. He gets along well with the staff. The engineers are rallying around him because they like working with him. Apparently he gets along very well with Gasly.
Yeah.
They're working together. The dynamic in the team is good. And that it's always a good sign if people are pulling for you. Always a good sign, even though it's said that Briatore still apparently wants Colapinto. Pinto.
And we all know that Briatore is calling the shots on a lot of these things as the shadow team principal of Alpine F1 team. Look, you can't deny that, like, in Q1, Jack Doohan was only 0.3 off the top time from Lando Norris. Like, that is a very encouraging result. It's just perplexing then that once Q2 rolls around, he's below the cut line, not even close.
Yeah, I think he's shown enough flashes of speed where I think he deserves more time. I think Alpine's playing this right. Give him till the summer break and see where we're at in August.
Yeah.
And go from there. If you've got Doohan on that shorter leash, okay, we'll play that game. I don't think Alpine needs to Red Bull this to make a point, right? Like they've got bigger problems to sort out than whether Jack Doohan's good enough to be here or not. On the cynical side of the coin, he has had two whoppers in terms of crashes.
Uh-huh.
Like Australia was bad. And Japan was horrible. Those were two big old wrecks, and that's the sort of shit that does not go over well with smaller teams. But if you could clean that up, keep it clean on track, and maybe score a point or two here and there, I think he'll be fine.
Yep. I think he needs to start scoring points, but he really... How many more big accidents does it have for them to really start to squirm about it? Because, okay, yes, we know Franco Colapinto, after the initial hot streak when he got here, did get a bit crash prone. There's a reason why people were still willing to overlook that during his brief time at Williams.
Because the old logic of you can't teach a slow driver to be quick.
Yeah.
But you might be able to mitigate a quick driver into not making mistakes. And I get that. I see the vision of Colapinto. Do not get me wrong. But after that hot streak died out, he had two whoppers of his own. He had two huge wrecks in Brazil. And then the Vegas qualifying jump was a whopper as well. That was a 50G crash in Vegas as well. That was a huge incident. So for all the hype around Colapinto, you could make the very strong case that he is just as much of a susceptible to error rookie that Doohan was coming in. So what are we really talking about here, in my opinion? I think they're one over the other, quite frankly.
And before anybody asks, I don't think Mick's coming back.
No.
I think the reason why your brother is so down on Jack Doohan is because he believed that was supposed to be Mick Schumacher's seat for the beginning. Mick Schumacher got a raw deal. I don't think he's coming back. Not in this setup.
He did get a raw deal at Haas. I'm not denying that. But again, as I've mentioned before on this show, Haas was a team that until last year was not operating under the full cost cap.
Yeah.
And when that happens, and then when Mick has three big wrecks that same season, the big one at Monaco, Saudi Arabia, Japan as well. At what point does the crash damage start to matter?
Yeah.
And Mick had three big ones. I still didn't agree with it, but I could understand why Günther wanted a safe pair of hands. And look, in hindsight, Nico Hülkenberg was fantastic at Haas. Genuinely outstanding. Like, it was like he was just better. There's no getting around it. And maybe the wrong man was moved along instead. That's a discussion for another day. But Mick was an Alpine. Mick had a straight up dogfight test against Jack Doohan and lost.
Yeah.
What more do you want to say? Like
it's tough.
Like, It's a tough break, but Mick will be a fine sports car driver, and there's no shame and disgrace in that. But
like, he's genuinely like one of the top three people in the Alpine setup, and he ate three. I don't know if he's one, but I know he ate three.
But that's the problem. Mick Schumacher was never anyone's number one option, and that's why he's not in F1 anymore.
Yeah, it's tough. Hopefully, Jack finds some of that form, stays things off. Ideally, there is a place for him and Franco Colapinto to be in the sport together. Ideally. We'll just have to wait and see.
Ideally.
Dre, update on the proposal to completely about-face the new engine regs and go to V10 engines on what is advertised as sustainable e-fuels. Turns out that was shot down immediately. The bosses have rejected the proposal. The only ones that were really in favor were Ferrari and Red Bull. Ferrari just does what they want because they are committed to Formula One, and Red Bull is kind of just like, I don't know what the deal is. But the bottom line was Mercedes, Honda, and Audi were all opposed. Audi's coming in, of course. Honda opposed. They're still a part of this. Cadillac not at the table. It kind of feels like this was just an ill-fated power play from FIA President Mohammed bin Sulayem to try and get some good favor with the fans that feel really alienated about the way he's doing things. Really, really alienated.
I think you got it in one. I don't think this was ever a realistic proposal. I don't even like, you know what it was? I have a theory. My theory is that Mohammed bin Sulayem is a boomer because he is 63 years of age. He's driven a V10 F1 car, infamously. And he was probably the sort of F1 fan that loved the visceral thrill of a V10 engine. There's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Yeah.
I just think the idea of big screaming V10 for the noise, for the thrill, for the aesthetics of it, combined with the big smoking gun of sustainable fuels, which aren't actually all that sustainable yet.
They haven't figured out a way to really make them as sustainable as they wanted to be. That's just it. They may come to that point in the future, but not yet. And ultimately, Audi doesn't want this. And look, we can dog on Audi for leaving all their previous endeavors just to be midfield and F1 if we want. But, like, do you really want to drive away another engine maker of Formula One when we're already losing one to begin with?
That's the thing, right? Say what you will about Formula One, the way it's run, the way it's being managed. You can do that till the cows come home. It is impossible to deny it has never been in a better place than it is right now in terms of manufacturer support and resources. By 2028, we're going to have, hopefully, 6 power unit manufacturers on this grid. 6.
Yeah, because General Motors is going to be able to build their own power units because the first 2 years, of course, Cadillac is going to be a Ferrari customer team, which is crazy.
But this is the point. The people don't want to accept the elephant in the room. The V10 was a gas-guzzling, inefficient mess of an engine that had no road relevance. And we were getting away from that some time ago. Formula One made a message clear years ago that they were going to push towards sustainability. They want to be carbon neutral by 2030. That's their aim. A V10 spits in the face of all of that. It's not an efficient engine. It was drinking fuel like crazy, as were the V8s that came afterwards.
Because they didn't really have to. Like, this was also an era of open refueling. You could refuel during races. They weren't building engines to be sustainable. They were building engines to just guzzle as much fuel, rev as fast as possible, put out as much power as possible. It was a different time back then.
I grew up in an era where F1 teams were going through 2 or 3 engines a weekend.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Because 1 and 2 were often blowing up in very spectacular fashion.
The reality is that V10s were never about sustainability or sustainability or anything along those lines.
Yeah.
They were always a hot mess. And they are no longer road relevant. Like, the whole reason Audi and Honda and Cadillac are going to be here is because there is road relevance in hybrid technology. These manufacturers have spent billions and billions of dollars developing hybrid technology to be as efficient as possible, and that technology will be passed down to their road cars and their infrastructure that will likely end up running the world's cars in the next 15 years. 10 in some cases, right? Imagine telling Honda and Audi and all the other guys out here, all those billions you spent on development, put it in the bin. We're going back to V10s again. They'll all quit like crazy. It's completely ridiculous. It was never, like, this shit was never, ever, ever a realistic option. This, in my opinion, was Mohammed bin Sulayem trying to appeal to the boomers and some of the big power players. And I think this was Stefano Domenicali calling his bluff and saying, go on then, give it a go, see what happens, and let MBS basically dangle on his own nuts, politically speaking.
Doesn't MBS also have bigger problems now that Robert Reed's quit the FIA too?
Robert Reed was one of the most respected people within the FIA.
Yeah, and before they that, he was there. A championship-winning World Rally co-driver, let's not forget.
He was universally respected amongst the FIA. His departure led to people like Natalie Robin coming out and saying, oh, by the way, he was great. He was not the problem here, because she released her first public statements in support of Robert Reed since she left the FIA last year. Like, they are losing senior officials at a rate of knots, and there's been back and forth open letters between the FIA and David Richards, the head of Motorsport UK. And the general theme has hung around the idea of transparency and the way the FIA has been run and officiated. And that man is up for re-election at the end of the year.
He's unopposed.
And I can tell you now, I don't think he will be. There's strong rumors that there will be a leadership contest at the end of the year for the FIA.
You don't think he's going to sign an edict that says nobody can run for president, I'm president for life?
He'd get a vote of no confidence the moment that gets pushed through. That would be as blatant a sign of this is just full-blown corruption than I've ever seen.
It's so like one step away from, like, making it rain on Sepp Blatter-type levels.
Yeah, so for me, Ben Salim's got a lot more to worry about right now than whether or not he's able to bring back his beloved V10s. I find it baffling that he's gone down this road when one of the few things he did get that genuinely earned him public favor was trying to expand the grid in the first place.
Yep. He's done that. Thanks for that. Where is everything else going?
He pushed Cadillac towards the door. And the FOM did not like him for that. And that was one of the few things he got right, in my opinion. Like, now you're walking it back by trying to shove people out the door by saying, yeah, we should have V10s instead. No, it's bollocks.
Yeah, it's not what it is. It's him trying to get good PR. If it appeals to people that just think, like, well, Donald Trump's been elected, so no more 2030 climate edicts. That's how this works. I don't think it's worked like that.
No, me neither. That'll just about do it for this episode of M101. It's been a busy one, a lot to get through on this episode. We barely even touched people like Liam Lawson getting 15 seconds worth of time penalties in that race. Rough. Formula One is back this weekend, the last part of a triple header, thank Christ. We've got Jeddah this weekend for the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. God, that came around again quick, didn't it? One of the quickest rounds we go to, 155 mile an hour, a lap average speed, a lot of high speed corners. Look, I'm not looking forward to this any more than you guys are. Maybe this won't suck. I'm not holding out much hope.
What do you think is good? Besides McLaren.
Red Bull might go well here. Downforce, good top end speed. Maybe Max can get in the mix here. But I still think it'll be a McLaren win.
That's what I'm expecting as well. Before we go as well, this weekend, and I know because we had Spencer Hall on the show recently as our guest for the F1 season preview, him, Holly Anderson, and all the folks at New American Pathways are having the annual Charity Bowl. Now, I know it is very college football themed, but we can all get around, like, helping refugees, settled into the United States. New American Pathways helps out with helping refugees find safe housing, get their children enrolled in school, job training, legal aid, language classes. They're based out of Atlanta, Georgia. They're running a charity drive that last year raised $1.1 million in support of New American Pathways. That charity is going on starting today when we record this, April 14th, through Friday, April 18th. We'll leave a link in the description of where you can get to it. And the fun thing about it is that the whole incentive is that you can donate based on how to spite your rival. Now, I know, again, it's American college football theme, but if I use like an example for motorsports, I'd say $420 on behalf of Mark Marquez University to celebrate all the points he scored in 2019, like just as like a throwaway example. I think it's cool. I know I'm going to donate. I know I'm also going to match to a Connecticut-based refugee assistance organization just because, you know, in these times, I think everybody could use some generosity like this. Again, link in the description. It's cool. It's a fun time. Just want to pass that forward. I'm looking forward to this week.
It's open. And a very powerful message there from RJ. And yes, I'm fully on board with that. Please support refugees where you can. And Spencer Hall's a good egg. The team at the Shutdown Forecast are great people. And I've always said sports fandom is built on hatred. And let's channel some of that into raising a lot of money for a very important and very good cause. It's only fitting. We'll be back later this week to talk MotoGP and its Grand Prix of Qatar as Marc Marquez took his third win in the last four rounds and a hammer blow to Pecco Bagnaia and sadly a pretty horrible weekend for one reigning world champion. More on that later in the week. And of course, IndyCar at Long Beach as well. As I can't believe I'm saying this, Alex Palou didn't win. I know, startling, right? We'll be back for more of that in the week. Until next time, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connor. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Yeah, later, y'all.
Our bikes coming back to a show near you.
Our bikes.